Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
My guest today is a former Marine attack helicopter pilot who flew hundreds of missions throughout the most war-torn and dangerous areas of the Middle East. He served on the staff of the Joint Chiefs. He was an associate professor of national security strategy and policy at the National War College and was special advisor to the commander of U.S. forces in Afghanistan. His book is called Ghosts of Baghdad. Colonel Eric Buhr, welcome to Can You Survive This Podcast?
Hey, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. So let's jump right in. Can you tell the audience a little bit about your military history? Like, when did you get into the military and what inspired you to join? Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. So I found the military kind of like most young men and women do. In my case, I was a freshman in college, and I was just thinking about what I wanted to kind of do already. Not the college anywhere close to being over. So I walked into a recruiter's office and found my way into a Marine. And those silver-tongued devils have a way of telling you they can promise you everything. But actually, I learned a lot. And he talked to me about becoming an officer, talked to me about the ability to go fly and flight training. And so I signed up. And it was a little of a culture shock for me. The Marine Corps does things a little bit different than you would expect. But it was a great fit. It's a team organization. They're team focused. And so I got a chance to go to flight training, and then time just kind of went by for me. So I graduated from college in 1988, decades ago now. But I served until 2016 when I retired as an air group commander. Yeah, but I loved it. I loved every minute of it. People ask me what I miss. Do I miss flying the attack helicopters? And of course I do. I miss the challenge, but you miss people. You miss the sense of focus and the sense of mission. You miss the camaraderie. A lot of shenanigans and a lot of fun times. So that's what I kind of miss the most. But yeah, I didn't think I'd be in the Marine Corps this long or that long. Just challenges kept coming, and I kept kind of accepting them. And then time kind of goes by, and then. And at some point in your life, you got to step off and you got to off ramp and find the next career.
So how did you end up becoming an attack helicopter pilot?
So when you go to flight training, the Navy trains, all Navy pilots, Coast Guard, Marine Corps pilots, along with a bunch of internationals. And so it's the needs of the service. So when I got through the initial stages of flight training, they say, hey, we need helicopter pilots. So I'm great. And then the next stage of training, you go through and you work as hard as you possibly can. And then at the end of the, when you get your, you're getting, become a winged aviator, they come back and they say, here are your opportunities. You can choose East Coast, West Coast, what type of aircraft you want based on your performance. And so I was fortunate. I selected Cobras. Because I knew it just kind of fits, kind of my mindset fits the mission. You support Marines on the ground, and we all support Marines on the ground. That's our focus, but I can do it in a way that really no one else can. And so that's what I found really unique and challenging about wanting to fly attack helicopters.
And so does that mean that you're the pilot of a helicopter and someone else is like, shooting weapons to provide cover, or what does the job kind of entail?
Yeah, so you, there's two pilots in all attack helicopters normally. So, you know, Apaches, the Cobras, those are two U.S. attack helicopters. So pilot in the front seat does the majority of the shooting. The pilot in the back seat can certainly shoot gun, shoot rockets, shoot some other specific type of weapons. But you're a team. You're kind of like one person executing the flying and the employment of the aircraft. And you always operate in a minimum of pairs. So there's always two aircraft flying at once, at least two, sometimes, you know, three, four at a time.
And did you spend a lot of time in the Middle East?
We did. You know, as a youngster, as a lieutenant and captain, I served in the Persian Gulf, served in Somalia, served in Bosnia. And then coming back, you know, doing multiple tours, I came back to the Cobra again, as a major and a lieutenant colonel, and did multiple tours in Iraq, flying Cobras. So did a good chunk of deploying time. You know, I don't have no near a record of the amount of deployments I did, but I got my fair share of deploying.
Wow. So can you share any stories from your time as a pilot where maybe you were in the Middle East, and any stories where maybe you had an experience where like you didn't think you'd make it out and somehow you survived?
Yeah, I've got a few of those. Yeah, the interesting thing about flying in general is I believe you always think you're going to make it out. You know, I believe any pilot worth their salt believes they're going to make it out until they don't. That's just the way it is. Like you're fighting the machine, you're fighting the weather, you're fighting an enemy, you're fighting conditions, and no one just throws their hands up in the air and says, well, that's it. You know, we're toast. It doesn't work that way. So I had a couple, you know, I'll just share the opening night in 2003 going over the border. It was in March of 2003, tremendous sandstorm. You really couldn't see more than probably 400 or 500 feet in front of you. And we were flying at about 100 feet, maybe a little bit higher, large formation. I'm leading two helicopters, and there's attack helicopters. There's two more attack helicopters. And we have a bunch of Marines we're trying to put into southern Iraq on the opening night of the war. And it was so dark. I mean, tremendously, tremendously dark. And you can get disoriented. I remember getting terribly disoriented. I've got my nose, the aircraft pointed right at the ground. And a young co-pilot in the front seat's like, hey, what are you doing? And the problem when that happens is your wingman is following you. And so I just feel, power come in, nose pitch up as I just try to fly through the ground. And so you didn't really have time to think about that as I try to, put us both there. And we roll into a target, and you roll into an active target. And then there's an enemy there. There's a thinking, agile enemy. And you got to quickly clear your brain of that and refocus. And then remember that it's not about me. It's about those Marines we're trying to put on the ground. It's about an enemy force that's trying to do harm to us and to them. And so you really have to, again, we talk about compartmentalizing what we're doing, but compartmentalize it. So it didn't sound as dangerous right now, but the entire flight was that way. The entire flight was every single person there really struggling to maintain awareness, flying in a sandstorm. And I remember when we landed, the mission wasn't as successful as we wanted. And planners on the ground were debating whether we were going to go again. And I could tell all of us you could look in each other's eyes and say, yeah, we go back out. We're just not going to come back. Like we've never flown those conditions ever again. And by hook or by crook, we got back. Some didn't. Tragically, some didn't that night. So that was really my wake up call. You know, I certainly had other events where the enemy gets a real active vote with me. And they voted often, as we'd say. But this one was really it's kind of a pinnacle event early on where you realize this type of flying is going to be like flying you've never done before.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
So in that scenario, it was really nature that was the biggest challenge.
It was me. It was on me to keep the aircraft up and flying, and it was absolutely nature. It was a sandstorm. You can't see. And we have night vision goggles. We have forward-looking infrared. We have the sensors to help you look through it. But night vision goggles can't see through a sandstorm. And it mutes all the light. And so normally, and it was a no moon night. So you count on the moon to give your night vision a little bit of extra illumination. And you count on stars if there's no illumination. We had really none. So it was super dark, super hard to see, super hard to keep yourself aware. But it was my job to, it's my job to do it. And in that case, I was, I gave myself a D. I didn't fail, but I was about as close as you could get.
Wow. Yeah, I can't imagine trying to. I mean, when I'm driving a car and I can't, if it's like stormy and I can't see, I'm like, oh man, what am I going to do? So I can't imagine adding in the factor of being in the air and then also being in a war zone. But yeah, so I guess if you can't see, are you just relying on the stars and the technology in the aircraft, and that's about it?
Yeah, so in that scenario, you're flying your instruments. So we have a heads up display in a Cobra, which gives you all your primary flight instruments. So you trust your instruments to keep on a steady altitude, steady airspeed, steady course. But you're also trying to follow a lead. You're looking for other aircraft. You're looking for an enemy. So you got a lot going on, trying to scan all these things at once. And if you're not paying attention, it can bite you. It can bite you real quick because you get spatially, we call it spatially disoriented. Like there's no ground reference. So makes that a little bit harder.
Yeah. And so this may be a dumb question, but like your instruments in the helicopter, if you were coming up on like a large hill or a mountain or a sudden change in like the elevation of the terrain, then your instruments would tell you that hopefully in time.
No.
No.
No, it's right. So we have what's called a radar altimeter. It tells you exactly how high you are above the ground, but it only tells you where you've been, right? So they have some aircraft have what's called terrain following and terrain avoidance radar. Like the B-1 has that. Some of the more sophisticated platforms have terrain following radar. We don't have a radar in this attack helicopter. So you're counting on your pre-flight preparation. You're counting on knowing the route you're flying. You're counting on knowing where all your man-made obstacles are and natural obstacles are. So it's really incumbent upon the pilots in their pre-flight planning to be aware of that.
Okay, I got it. So you're doing a lot of pre-preparation to understand, okay, this is my route, and then this is where there's maybe a mountain over here or a hill over here or a building over here. So you know ahead of time what might be coming.
Absolutely. I would say particularly for, well, initially for flying combat missions, your preparation could have been days and days and days. In the brief, normally it's about a 2-hour brief. And in our case, we can fly for about 2 hours. Then you come back and you debrief it for as long as you need to capture all your lessons learned. And then, wash, rinse, repeat, as it goes. And you try to get better on each evolution. You try to learn the things that are important to brief, not to brief in each environment you fly in has its own specific challenges. Like there's certain things we just didn't worry ourselves with there. But then, early on, weather, no moon, and of course, we spent the majority of our time worrying about a pretty agile enemy.
Yeah, that reminds me. I remember the story when they got Bin Laden. Didn't they train like the because the walls were different than what they trained? Like, didn't one of the helicopters actually crash land in that mission?
It did. That's a really that's a such a classified mission. But I know the Army were putting in the special operators in a highly modified Black Hawk H-60 that had some you build angles and so it has a lower radar cross. Radar can see helicopters, but has a lower radar cross section. Probably had ways to suppress the motors. I think just by co happenstance, it had a malfunction. I don't think the pilots, these pilots who were flying them are, they're from the 160th Special Operation Aviation Regiment in the Army. The best pilots in the world. I mean, I'd love to say I was, could fly at their level. Those are the best helicopter pilots in the world. And I think it was a malfunction in that aircraft. And they, end up crashing in that whatever you call that courtyard, and they had to destroy it in place there. But yeah, I've looked for that story. You know, I'm waiting to hear more about the helicopter, and I, you know, it's one of those you don't really hear more about it because we like cool things, and that was a pretty interesting part of that mission.
Yeah, we had many years ago on the podcast, we had Rob O'Neill on, and he talked about that mission. And he mentioned that the helicopter pilot actually saved their life because of how, you know, he had to crash land it in a way that didn't just completely destroy everything, but it was some sort of crash landing, I believe.
Yeah, I think you're right. But like I said, those 160th pilots, I mean, they're the best helicopter pilots in the world. They simply are, you know.
Yeah. And is it true that they have to destroy it once it's, if it's broken and you can't get it out of there, you actually have to destroy it so that like none of the technology can be stolen? Do you know anything about that?
I don't know about that specific case, but certainly in the past we've had aircraft that have gone down, and they'll find a way to bring demo teams in, or if they have to, they'll bring in fixed wing aircraft and they'll bomb it. So, because you got classified radios on there, you have other classified equipment, and you have technology, like real technology, that whether it's anti-missile, anti-radar missile, anti-heat-seeking missile, other technology you just don't want any enemy to have easy access to.
Yeah, got you. So how long were you in the Middle East?
So in this case, the war, I did three tours in Iraq. I did the tour in 2003. Then came back again up in the Sunni Triangle in 2004, and then went back there again in 2005.
Gotcha. And what were you doing after you were in the Middle East? You were in the military for several more years. What were you doing after that?
So kind of a natural progression in my case, in my services. I left command as a lieutenant colonel in 2006. We got home from Iraq, and then I went off to the war college. And that's a natural progression. You go to the war college, you spend a year. In my case, it was a fantastic year. Get to reconnect with old friends. You get to spend time with your family. You have to move again, but that's just what happens. And you get a chance to study and think of, you know, a lot of, you're preparing yourself really for your next job. And so, after that, I went up and I served on the staff of the chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And that is, everyone thinks, oh, the Pentagon, you know, it's such a grind. You never want to go there. And it is a grind, and it's a lot of work. But, again, the people you work, you get to work with some amazing people. And so you have access to see the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, right? All the service chiefs are in the building, and get a chance to interact with them, for me, at a lower level, but you get to see how they work with their staffs, get to see how the chairman works with the Secretary of Defense, and how the Secretary. So you learn all these kind of inner workings of the military and through that of the government. So very educational for me. I enjoyed my time up there. I enjoy the stretch, but I enjoyed it because you learned a lot. I didn't enjoy it. You know, you don't enjoy the commute. You don't enjoy the long hours. You don't enjoy being stuck in DC. I-95 traffic. You don't enjoy that part, but you do enjoy the fact that you're getting professionally, you're growing.
Yeah. What kind of stuff? I'm sure a lot of this is probably confidential, but can you share, like, what kind of stuff were you learning when you were there?
You really learn everything. I mean, so I was in a very specific directorate, and my work was really NATO-focused. So it was really NATO-focused with the alliance, how we can work better and more align our capabilities. And so I got to do a fair amount of travel to NATO countries and work with them. But you learn everything, how the intelligence is gathered and work. You understand better operations, how all the military services are synced, and then how the combatant commanders, you know, which all over the geographic combatant commanders use the forces. You learn about the logistics and the communications and the acquisition sides of it. So you get a taste of everything. But where I worked, I was really focused on how we improve our relationships, how we improve the doctrine, the training within our allies, particularly in NATO.
This is another question that I don't know if you'll be allowed to answer, but as far as like how we gather intelligence and that kind of thing, is our government's like ability just way more advanced than like what the average person would assume?
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, so I had a top secret clearance, but the methods and the means of intelligence gathering is so compartmentalized. It's so far above me. I really don't know. I mean, it's impressive to understand how we have drones flying, our predators, and all those types of assets. It's impressive to see satellite imagery and the imagery we have from our intelligence gathering, fixed wing platforms we have out there. But the specifics, like I said, the means and the methods, really, I don't know any more than your average American does, right? Because those people, that's their job, that's their life. And then all the ground intelligence, again, that's a whole separate function, whether it's through DOD means or it's through other means.
So I have another helicopter question. Sure. How many times would you say you've flown, like hundreds of times?
Thousands of times. Oh yeah. So I don't have a count, but I had a couple 4,000 hours when I retired, and most all of that was in helicopters. So you don't really know, but you get a lot of reps and sets in training, I tell people it's like two separate careers you have. There's your administrative flying, all the building blocks, you learn how to navigate and communicate and shoot. And then there's combat flying, which is fundamentally decision-making and understanding the environment. That's the art of it. The science is being taught how to fly it and fly it effectively and employ it to a certain extent. But then the art is your decision-making, right? Decisions are just inherently bear weight. And when you're flying, you're not just making decisions for yourself. You're making decisions for your wingmen. You're making decisions for commanders on the ground that affect them. So there's a seriousness to it all. But the numbers of times you fly, it just builds, particularly overseas where you'd fly. Normally we'd have a long day flying back home would be 4 hours. You have two sorties. You go back out twice. I remember the second night coming back and I was telling my skipper, I said, "Hey boss, I just flew over 13 hours. And per our guidance, our manuals, we can only fly 6.5 hours. That's all you can fly in a day. There's some exceptions to that. So, our squadron through our higher headquarters had to put waivers in immediately. We're not going to stop flying. And so that's another thing we all learned as a team was that, the effects of fatigue, right? So we began tremendously fatigued after days where you're flying 12, 13, 14 hours. Then you're drinking some really hot water and you're laying down on a cot in the sun. Cause I was a night guy trying to get some sleep. And then you get up and you go do it again. So there's a cumulative level of fatigue that happens. You and I can gut through anything for a week or 10 days, but when it starts to go months, it really begins to, impact you.
Yeah, that can have the fatigue, lack of sleep and rest can have like very severe physical and psychological effects.
It does, and so I think, one thing that really has helped me was I did my first deployment. You come back and you kind of process what's happening, but then you go right back. So you don't have like that was your one snapshot in time of what that war looked like. So you had a chance to, you're back in it again. So you have a chance to answer some of your own questions that you have. And you talk with your fellow, Marines. And, I think it's that part of it's helpful. One thing I saw was just amazing. I'm talking about the Army again, giving them more kudos. They'd go on, 14-month deployments, 14-month deployments. And so you talk to pilots. I've done a couple of podcasts with retired Army guys and they're great. And they're like, they'd be flying 900, 1,000 hours in a year, which is, that's a career's worth of, that's a career's worth of flying you're doing in a deployment. And then coming home and refitting and doing that again. And Marine Corps did 7-month deployments kind of at the squadron level. The bigger units would stay longer, but it was always as hard as I think I would be working. And I never really believed I was working, but I knew I was working hard. You don't have to look far to realize there's a lot of people working a lot harder than you are. And it's motivating and it's kind of inspirational in itself.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. So this is a kind of bizarre question for you. with thousands of hours in the air, have you ever seen anything that you just have, you just cannot explain that? Like anything that you saw that you're like, what the hell was that?
You know, I haven't seen any UFOs, you know. So I think that one Navy F-18 guy's got the piece on that. You know, I had an experience, and it goes to a bigger, longer day that I had. It was just a day that I'd never experienced. And, you learn to, you know, I call it, you know, kind of leading in ambiguity. And it's hard because you do so many things for the first time, right? And there's no playbook for it. There's no manual to teach you how to do it. This is kind of what I was talking about, where you just have to learn and you don't give up and you keep flying. I was flying north, going into Baghdad. This is the 1st of April. And I'd landed at a forward arming and refueling point. There was these little mini convoys that the Marine Corps put, you know, right behind or sometimes ahead of our units. And they had gasoline and ordnance for us. It was really important. And they had mechanics there, really important. So little things wrong with the helicopter, they could tune up. And I landed this one place and it was chalky. We're the first people to land there. Chalky, chalky dust. And you really couldn't see anything. And both my wingman and I land and we're getting ready to take off. And my wingman says, "Hey, I can't start my number two engine." We normally shut one engine down. We're putting gas in. And I've got to make that choice. I got to leave them. You know, I'm going to go fly. I'm going to link up with another two helicopters from my squadron. And we're going to go fight the fight. And so tough decision, but there's security there. And, you know, I report everything I should. So anyway, I go to take off and we take off and I can't see anything, but it's basically you're trusting your instruments and you just got to push the nose forward and you'll fly through it and you'll start flying. And my co-pilot's like, "Hey, there's a truck in front of us. You need to climb." And so I just pull power. And before I can know it, I lose tail rotor authority, which means your tail rotor is countering the torque from the main rotor and it can only take so much. So the tail boom and the tail rotor just comes flying over my left shoulder and we do a full 360 in the air and we do another 360 and my co-pilot, you know, later on my wingman says, "Yeah, we're just waiting for the explosion." I'd never had that happen to me before. So we're super heavy. We don't have enough power. We got to keep flying. And so my co-pilot's telling me, "Just take the power out, you know, power out. And I'm like, "I don't have time to communicate." I'm like, "Dude, I'm not taking power out." So I can fly wings level. And we're spinning, but I was waiting to get above the cloud dust. So we're spinning, spinning, spinning. We finally get above the cloud dust and I finally get a way to take power out and the aircraft slowly rights itself. And, you know, we don't talk for the next 10 minutes. So I'd never seen that before. It wasn't a UFO, but it was another example of me trying to kill my co-pilot. You know, he did nothing wrong. And, you know, it's just lessons learned. You know, place we'd never been. We were at our max. We were probably over our max gross weight the helicopter could take because we had full load of ordnance. We had full load of fuel. I should have known better. I should have probably walked in front of me 100 yards, but you couldn't see 100 yards in front of you. We just assumed there was nothing in front of us. So, yeah, that's as close as I'll get to a UFO, I think.
Wow. So that was a mechanical issue that caused you to basically go into 360s?
Aerodynamic issue. So I'm asking my tail rotor to... You know, the tail rotor pushes you sideways to counter the torque of the main rotor. I'm asking that tail rotor to do more than it can do. It can't push that hard. So what you have to do is you got to get forward airspeed, and then forward airspeed lets the torque demand decreases once you get flying. So that's as best as an econ major can explain. You might have to talk to an aerodynamics engineer.
That sounds terrifying. I'm surprised that neither of you like lost your lunch during that experience.
We didn't have time. I mean, I just say it like we flew over and it was a crazy night. We flew over to meet up with my executive officer at the time. We found where they were, and as we landed, we got mortared. You know, Marines are getting wounded, and it was a long, long night. But you know, we just we persevered and we just pressed through that one.
And so, okay, so during the 360 situation, he said there was a truck ahead of you that you had to avoid. What was that?
That's what he said. That's what I heard him. He's like, "Hey, there's a truck in front of us." I'm like, "What? There's a truck. You got to climb." And I'm like, "Now?" He's like, "Now." Because normally, if I just push the nose over, it's like an aircraft taking off, getting up speed. We call it translational lift. The helicopter almost acts like an aircraft. The rotor acts like a wing and you take off. I just didn't have enough speed. I had to climb now. So I just pulled power, and I pulled more power than the tail rotor could counter. And so you spin. The main rotor gets you spinning.
You were actually, this may be a dumb question, so I'm sorry, but you were low enough to the ground that you were almost going to hit a parked vehicle, or is the truck like an enemy who's going to shoot at you?
I never knew what it was. It could have been this was an abandoned Iraqi airfield we just put our group in there. So I didn't know what it was. I never saw it. I just knew there's an obstacle in front of me I didn't want to smash into. So yeah, we spun and spun until probably got to 50, maybe 75 feet. And we got above the cloud dust. The cloud that was created by all the dust. And once you take enough power out, and kind of what we do is you pick the power out, you push the nose of the helicopter forward, it'll right itself. It'll fly into the relative wind and it starts to fly more like an airplane. That was sporty. It was, event number two, salty major trying to kill a young captain, you learn from it. Nothing you can do about it. Didn't mean to do it.
Sporty. That is a interesting way to describe that. Wow. So can you tell us a little bit about your book? It's Ghosts of Baghdad. When did you write it and what inspired you to write it? And can you tell a little bit what's it about?
Sure. It's like a blue angel flying over my house right now. You can probably hear it in the background.
Are you close to like DC or Annapolis?
I live in Pensacola, Florida.
Gotcha.
Yeah. So it's the home of the Blues. I think I was just a F-18 flying by. So the book, it was in my brain. I took a lot of notes on that deployment and other deployments. Second book coming out later this year, early next year. I really wanted to tell our story. I want to tell our collective story. And, when you look at the book, when you read the book, you realize it's not about me saying, look at me. It's seen through my lens. It's told through my voice. But it's all of our stories, right? It could be your neighbor. It could have been your brother, your sister, your father. So it tells a story. And these are Marines. These are people from all over the country, all over the world, and stories that needed to be told. So that was my motivation. And selfishly, what I liked was I got a chance to reconnect with old friends, whether it was an old, retired colonel, general, sergeant. It was just great reconnecting with them. And it was also amazing to understand their perspectives of things, what they saw and what I saw. And I took those into account, but it's interesting. I can only tell a story about what I see. And so, there was a lot of motivations. I think, again, it's a story that needs to be told. It doesn't need to be a story that's told in 25 more years in some lionized version of the past, right? It's what happened to this generation of aviators, right? It's not another, I love them. I love all the good, good Spielberg movies on Second World War and, Tom Hanks. Those are, they're legendary. This is real. These people are your neighbors now. These are young men and women that were asked to do incredible things. It's almost hard sometimes to put yourself back into a post 9/11 world. It's 18 months after 9/11. Views were dramatically different about what we think is right and what in hindsight people think is right and wrong. And that's for historians to debate and, those in, live in the social sciences to debate. That's not to me. But I was proud to write it. I was proud to represent a generation, to write it and tell our collective story. And it lets you, I think for most readers, it lets you step into a place you've never been before. You open the door, take a step into a attack helicopter, you close the canopy, and you get to see it for what it is. And like I said, it's unvarnished. I'm the most flawed character in the book, and it's me telling you exactly what happened, right? So trying to kill myself and my wingman on the opening night, just because I'm not good enough at the time. I just got to get better. Ghosts of Baghdad, right? We'd all seen ghosts, right? I talk about, and when you're a kid, what makes you sprint home from your neighbor's house at night? You don't know. Something's out there. You just don't know what it is. You know it's going to get you, and you got to run. And so as time went on and these events began to unfold, I would tell you honestly, I started to get that feeling. I started to get a feeling of dread, sinking feeling, kind of like a blanket on you. And I felt like someone was chasing us, and there's nothing you can do about it. It's irrational. And you fight through it and you try to compartmentalize, and Ghost gets a vote, and we lose more aircraft, right? We'd still lose more aircraft, more people would be killed. And it's a real living and breathing thing out there. That's, in my mind, best describes, what we went through collectively. So, it's less than 30 days, you strap in, and then, the book ends, and we're up in Saddam's hometown of Tikrit, which is the top corner, the northeast corner of the Sunni Triangle, as they would become known. So yeah, that was my motivation for writing it. That's my perspective on it. And that's what I think hopefully tells a compelling story.
So is it your true story? It's about you. It's not a fiction, right? It's yours. Is it like a collection?
Yeah.
It's your memoir. Okay.
Absolutely. Right. So, yep.
Does it take the reader through like various missions that you did sort of in the early 2000s in the Middle East?
It takes you from the opening night of Operation Iraqi Freedom 1 to what I thought was the last night of real fighting, which is the second week of April, when we had already gone through Baghdad and we're up in Tikrit. And so it takes you from the opening night, and I close it off pretty much 23 days later.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So you're with me. You're in the opening night. You're flying in Basra. You're meeting the troops of Chemical Ali. You're flying in Nazaria. You're flying in Baghdad, outside of Baghdad. You're getting to meet guys on the ground, friends of mine that I, met that were in tanks, light armored vehicles. They were infantry officers. You get a little of their perspective of what we were doing for them, or in some cases not doing for them. And so that's it. I try to inform the reader without being distracting, right? So certain things I thought were important. That's, you read not comparing myself to any of these people, clearly. You read a Tom Clancy novel, sometimes he can describe a nuclear reactor or the propulsion of or the catapult on an aircraft carrier to such, take four or five chapters in describing that. There's other writers, fiction writers, that will simply, like a Grisham book, he just uses law. He's an attorney, but just uses law as the backdrop. And it's a vehicle for him to tell stories. And so clearly I'm neither of those. But what I wanted to do was be able to inform the reader, let them know this is what type of ship we're on. This is how we're configured. This is kind of how daily operations happen on a ship. And very briefly, what is a Hellfire missile? What guides it? What is a 20 millimeter gun? What's an M1A1 tank? Within reason, right? So without being distracting, but keep the story pressing. So when they leave, I've not only taken them on a journey, but they have an understanding of, hey, this is what a Marine Corps does. This is what a Marine Corps does for our country.
That must have been a very intense 23 days. I'm curious, did those 23 days feel like forever? Did it feel like a year?
Yeah, that is a great question. In some ways it did. There was, it snapped you into a new normal so quickly. And there was no, I talk about expectations. Sometimes I talk to folks, and like for us, expectations are the kryptonite to any aviator. Expectations mean we've thought through how this event or this flight or this single mission will end. And that's just so dangerous. It's a level of complacency, which is just deadly. And so every day was new. Every day was different. We try to manage, any expectations of what was happening. But it, unlike further tours that I would do there, what made it, I think, added stress to everyone was there was no end in sight, right? So future ones, you show up, you and I show up, and it's like, hey, great, we're coming. We're going to be there for 6 months, 7 months, whatever it's going to be. We have a start date. We have an end date. You and I can start marking calendar days, right? It's just good. People do that. We had no clue. And then after we went into the southern town of Nazaria, the Army went in first. That was the famous Jessica Lynch convoy, the 507th Maintenance Company, and they got turned around and they got ambushed. we sent Marines in there and they got ambushed, and we're like, oh, this is a different war than we thought it was going to be. And so that's when we all, a big sandstorm hits. There's all these little setbacks that we just had to keep overcoming and overcoming, and we just were waiting for the next one to happen. So, what made that, again, make it a little more stressful than, further deployments, was just not knowing when it was going to end. You just never know what the next day is. There's no mature battle space you're operating in. Every day is a brand new day for you.
I like to collect quotes from my guests, and you said a really good one. That's complacency is deadly. I think it's really good. I'm going to put that in the book. So you mentioned that you said that this war is different than we thought. Can you expand on that a little bit? Like how was it expected to be versus like what was different than what people thought it was going to be?
Yeah. So from my cockpit, we'd been briefed before we even went over the first night. There was thousands of air to air AAA anti aircraft artillery fired. There was thousands of missiles being shot, radar emitters flying. We'd put our gas masks on. We're running into these tunnels just right south of the Iraqi border as they shot ballistic missiles from the from Iraq down, trying to hit our ships and our bases. But beyond that, we were looking at 400,000 regular, Iraqi troops. That's five corps, 16 divisions. Then we had their Special Republican Guard, another 75,000 as you get closer to Baghdad, right? So that was those 75,000 broken into six divisions, all with much more modern weapon systems. Then when in Baghdad, there was this, quote, Special Republican Guard, right? There was the 15,000 of Saddam's elite, the best of the best there to prevent coups and do all the other things they do. So we're looking at this massive force. They clearly outnumbered our force. And expectations, like, they're deadly. They're like, well, just you're going to be fighting maybe the second tier armies down there. They're not Sunnis. They're mostly Shia, and they're conscripts. They're probably going to run away from their weapons and not care. Now, that happened. And there were also, some Iraqi company commanders leading their 200 men who were incredibly motivated, incredibly dedicated, who were going to fight and fight and fight and fight. So you treated every threat as if it was the most capable force you're going against. Otherwise, you put yourself and your crews, in peril. You simply do. So that's what I mean. It unraveled here and there places, but it didn't go as people maybe thought it would go, right? The first Gulf War, mass surrenders, you name it, it all happened, the bombing campaign, and those troops stuck in Kuwait in southern Saudi Arabia, then through Kuwait up to the border. They surrendered by the hundreds of thousands. We didn't know, but that was in the back of our mind. These folks, maybe they're going to surrender early. And there was a lot of surrendering, like I said, but there were hotbeds, like the city of Basra, where the Brits were, where famous Chemical Ali, Saddam Hussein's, first, it was his first cousin. He'd use chemicals against the Kurds and use chemicals against the Iranians. He'd run the secret police, and he was running that force in Basra. So it was a pocket that we bypassed, but it was a place we'd have to go back when they had some, pretty well-trained troops there.
Did you say it was his nickname Chemical Ali?
That was his nickname, Chemical Ali. Wow. So Ali, yeah. So if you look up Chemical Ali, you pop him up. It's Ali, and he was, there's a famous scene that Saddam Hussein filmed back when he took power. I believe in 79. I got to look when that was, where he has all his. It's a big auditorium filled with politicians, and Chemical Ali, his cousins behind him, who were in the secret police. That's where they just started calling out names, and those folks were just taken out, never to be seen. Some to be seen again, most not to be seen again. It was all part of, it's Dictator Handbook 101, right? So it's the absolute, the threats of being, whacked by your leader, So pardon me for one second. I got to let this dog.
You let your dog out?
big white Swiss Shepherd. It's my one of my kids' dogs. he started. I wonder why I could hear the jets. My door's open. He wanted to go outside the backyard, so I got to let him out.
Nice. He'll attack me. So you got a big huge dog.
It's pretty big dog. You know, it's my youngest daughter's, and so unfortunately lost our dog recently. But both my daughters have a couple cool. I got three daughters, but they all have pretty cool dogs, so they're allowed to stay here when they want them. So.
Absolutely. Amazing. So, the dictator just using that fear as a tactic, I guess. So coming up closer to like today or modern day, you know, post 9/11 was a long time ago. And, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned how there was even like a different mindset back then, because sometimes I watch like even like old TV episodes from like, you know, early 2000s, and I can at least really get a sense of how people's mindset was really different. But I guess we'll see what the historians say about it. We got out of the Middle East supposedly a year or two ago, and I remember watching the news with the people hanging off the airplane and begging us not to go. And I was just like, really, there's just so much suffering. And I'm curious, can you share any opinion about how we got out of there?
Yeah. So how we left Afghanistan, you know, it's a national disgrace. I mean, it's a tragedy. We can divest ourselves from our, that support, direct support of the war, but and we promised those people, we looked them in the eye and we promised them, you know, you can count on us. We promised you, right? Your daughters will actually get to leave the house. Your daughters will actually be educated. We're going to try to have some levels of services and invest in infrastructure of water and electricity and education. All the things that scare any dictator, all the things that scare any oppressive religion. They don't want anyone. That's what they, you know, it's why they, you whack lawyers, you whack teachers, you suppress women, you suppress more than half your population. You write things into law that suppresses them and any chance for them to grow. So it was tragic. I mean, there were so many other ways we could have found to divest ourselves from Afghanistan. And divest ourselves mean a political solution. The Taliban had to be reasoned with at some point. We did kill so many Taliban that probably a lot of the pragmatic leaders were gone, but there was the potential of a political solution and to find a way for Afghanistan to flourish as it should and their people to flourish and not turn our backs on people that we told could trust. We could trust them, you know, and they could trust us. It's disheartening.
Yeah. I consider myself a very apolitical person, but I was really heartbroken. I don't even watch much news on TV, but I remember seeing that footage of the people just like clinging to the airplane, begging us not to go. And I was just really heartbroken by that and seeing that suffering. And I had a veteran on a few weeks ago who talked about, he knew people that were calling, you know, people that were locals to that area that worked with us, and they were calling their American contacts, just begging us, please don't leave us and please help us. And, we just left them. So it's really devastating and sad. And there's really no winners in that situation, in my opinion.
No, it's there's nothing. I mean, you got the guilt of those of us who served in Afghanistan. Clearly, my level of effort in Afghanistan was as a staff guy, and it was limited. So it's not. There's so many other folks who gave so much and built those relationships. And I couldn't imagine having those types of phone calls. And those stories are still being told. And I know there's still efforts to get folks out. But you know, the die was cast, and this administration. So that's how we're going to do that. And it's on them. It's their legacy. You know, it's their legacy, our legacy, those that serve their legacy. They got to, you know, they put their chin up high and they know they serve with honor and distinction, and the administration has to, that's going to be their legacy when it's written. So.
Yeah. And, you know, speaking of this administration, and maybe you can provide some of your, I would consider your expert opinion. And myself as complete, like, I know very, very little about how all this works, but I just know sort of like the surface level, what I hear on the news, which I even try to avoid news because I find it really stressful and biased. But, you know, I remember 2017 through 2020 being told like, we're in danger and then war is going to break out and World War III is going to come. And now suddenly here we are with the next administration. And I feel like there's more war. So do you have any opinion on that? Or am I misunderstanding what's going on?
Yeah. You know, I think, talk about being able, I'm, we're all political in some sense. But it's just, it's been very difficult, right? It's very difficult when you operate from a position of weakness, particularly in the Middle East, where they understand a gun in the face. It's primitive in so many ways, right? We don't have the luxury of, they haven't had the luxury of sitting on a U.S. campus and studying philosophy and history and understanding how to be pragmatic. It doesn't work, right? And we also have a level of immaturity when I look at college campuses of understanding they hate you for who you are. They'll never sit down with you and talk with you ever. They hate you for who you are and they want to kill you. And it's not irrational to them. It's perfectly rational. It's perfectly logical. And you have to just accept that. And to do otherwise is at your own peril, right? It's, they say weaponless dreamers die at the hands of bad men all the time. It happens throughout history. Roll it back. Just go back. I listen to a lot of history. I read a lot of history. Just reading about the fall of the city of Petra and all, it's just amazing about trade routes, but it's all about competition, competition for wealth, competition for resources, competition for populations that provide them that wealth and resources. So the Middle East is no different right now. It's the Iranians. It's a proxy. They're the proxy wars. They funded and trained and helped plan what Hamas did on October 7th to the Israelis. It's unconscionable what they did. It was a massacre and they targeted civilians and children and people and families. They could no way ever defend themselves. It's Hezbollah, who was trained and again equipped by the Iranians. We saw the attack on Tower 22 recently that killed three Americans, right? By the Islamic Resistance of Iraq, another force trained by the IRGC, the Islamic Republic, the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps of the Iranians. Specifically, they call them their Quds forces or their special forces. So their fingerprints are all over that. And we look at what's happened with the Houthis, right? The Houthis started off as a political movement with the brother Hussein. Abdul, his younger brother, now runs it after he was assassinated. But, they're taking on international shipping. They're trying to shut down international shipping lanes. And on the ground with them are Iranian forces with Iranian missiles. Those small organizations, they can't build, fly, maintain very advanced drone systems like the one that was used in Tower 20. It is the Iranians, right? So it's the Iranians. And so they perceive weakness, right? They perceive weakness. And so that's what's been really difficult in the Middle East side. We could talk about Russia and Ukraine or other hotspots. But right now it's those proxies have to be isolated. And we are all, I'm very sympathetic to Palestinians. Those Palestinian people have done nothing wrong. They really haven't. The people, their government, their elected government, Hamas, has squandered billions and billions. Where's the infrastructure? Where's the electrical grids? Where's water? Where's food? Where was an after plan? After you did this attack on the Israelis, did you think nothing was going to happen? Except you want to use your own people as human shields. We know that, right? So that's a common occurrence for them. But, where's the international outcry on that, right? So it's complex. It's a very, very tense world right now. I would agree with you.
Yeah, and I think there's, unfortunately, a lot of suffering on both sides. As in the West, I feel like sometimes are just given one side or the other, and I think there's suffering on both sides. And I'm wondering, do you see any way that this kind of scales back around the world? Or do you think, is war just the way the world is going to be? Or is there a way, do we have some kind of hope?
I certainly hope so. I believe so. I just wrote a piece on proxies and, I kind of focused a little bit on the Houthis and got to find out what they, there's got to be a political solution for them. Like their course right now is they're in a death spiral. If they don't know it, they may not know it, but they're in a death spiral. They have to solve the problem internally with the Yemeni government. They have to solve it internally with the Saudis. They open up another front on the internationals when you're firing ballistic missiles at shipping and you're trying to hit. They're a loose cannon. They just fired on an Iranian supply ship coming in from Brazil a couple of days ago. And so they're going to open a third front against the U.S. It's a recipe for death and destruction. And you hate to see it happen, right? That doesn't have to happen. So how do you get them to the table to say, hey, listen, this is not going to get you anywhere you want to go. It's not going to get you anywhere you want to go. And they're radical. You read the Houthis, their charter is God is great. You know, death to Israel, death to Jews, death to America. And there's a couple of people, they're same with Hamas, death to America, death to Israeli, death to the Jews. They want the land back. It's just what they preach. So it's difficult, but there has to be some type of political solution for it. You can't be in a persistent state of not just conflict, but active war. And the blowback on the Israelis is so unfair. If anyone is left out or reached out with an olive branch more than the Israelis, I'd love to know who that is. Up and down the border, there's Israeli and Palestinian and other Muslim neighborhood. They're just intertwined with the culture where they live in harmony. You know, just they have different religions, but they live in harmony. And that's been in great part to the Israelis. But they've been pounded on since 1948 hard. To think that there are somehow the Palestinians are the victims of Hamas, which is, very much different than saying the Israelis are the aggressor and they need to stop and begin rebuilding, in this case, the Gaza Strip. So, yeah, not an easy one. There's been a lot of great minds trying to solve this problem for millennia. And I don't know that there's going to be a short answer, but it would be great, really, if we could ensure the proxies of Iran are put back in their place and then go back and specifically look at the Israeli Hezbollah and Hamas issues, which just now it really is a humanitarian disaster, but it's a disaster that could have been avoided.
Yeah. Well, I hope that we can find a political solution sooner than later. And thank you for sharing your opinions on this. So you mentioned, we'll pivot a little bit. You mentioned you're working on another book. Can you talk about a little bit about your next book, or is that all kind of under wraps right now? Or
no. So right now we've got Ghosts of Baghdad has really been our focus. I'm trying to get that bubble wrapped and shipped out west to the folks in Hollywood to see what they can do with that for us.
I'll ask your people for a copy because I don't think I have one yet, but I'm out here in Hollywood. So we'll see what we can do.
Oh, 100%. Yeah. I would love any help. I'm out in California, start next week, for some other work, but, the next book is called Devil in the Triangle, and it picks up in the summer or spring of 2004. When I go back for my second tour, and it's amazing how much has changed in a very short period of time. We're now flying out of this small Iraqi airbase called Al-Takadum that's right in between the flashpoint cities of Fallujah and Ramadi, and only about a 20-minute flight into Baghdad. And so it picks up there, and it'll carry you through that. And we get some wins. We have some tremendous losses from a very personal side of it. And so it kind of expand the aperture a little bit, get to understand more, a little more of the culture of what I'm trying to get across. And then we'll do that for deployment in 2004 and we'll wrap it up after the deployment in 2005. So that'll be the last memoir I'm going to write. And then, the plan is to turn to some writing about my experiences in Afghanistan, really kind of from a novel side, but a historical based. And so that's the intent there. So yeah, got some plans. So we're trying to get through that.
Amazing. Well, I look forward to it. I forgot to ask, speaking of your books and your memoirs, Is it true that there is in Ghosts of Baghdad, there's a scene about collecting souvenirs? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Yeah. Thank you for bringing that up. No. So, yeah, you know, I some leadership lessons not to follow. I definitely have a few in there. So as we began to move north, and really the heavy, some of the most heavy, the fighting we knew was it had slowed. Your mind wanders, right? You know, where they say idle time, idle hands do the devil's work, right? So, first time we were headed up and going north to the city of Tikrit, and we looked down in my Dash 3, my third aircraft, which was a Huey, said, "Hey, sir, you see that? I don't recall it. You know, see that target down there off our right wing?" And I looked down and I can't see anything except a big flagpole. What was a military outpost, which is abandoned, on top of that flagpole is a big Iraqi flag flying. And so I'm like, "Hey," I'm like, "all right, you're going to go get that high value target." So, you know, I immediately regretted the decision. You know, the Huey just kind of, you know, rolls into a heavy angle of bank, and they're hovering right next to this flagpole, and wind's blowing. I'm like, God, if anything happens to this Huey, and they're trying to, and it just was windy. And so they land, and I'm like, all right, Jesus. So the crew chief jumps out. I'm like, oh my God, now we've got a guy on the ground. We don't know what's going on. It could be mine. We don't know what's happening. So yeah, Sergeant Deal, Corporal Deal, I only Sergeant Deal at the time. You see him sprinting like a world-class sprinter, hits up, you know, these are 6-foot walls. You know, he jumps up like a Marine obstacle course, flies over it, next wall, flies over it. And then grabs the flag, pulls the flag down, and sprints back and hops in the airplane, takes off. I'm like, oh my God, that was stupid. And so we get gas, and then we head up to the Air Force Academy just outside of Tikrit. And there's no one there. No American forces have been there yet. And I see there's flags flying, and there's an academy. And I'm like, sorry, this is. So I tell my co-pilot, "Hey, we're going to land and I'm going to hop out. I'm just going to take a quick peek in these buildings." And he's probably looking at me, like, "You got to be kidding me." So I land and I hop out. I grab my M4 and I'm like, "Hey, listen, things turn south. Just take off, right? Just take off. Don't. You just leave me here, right? I've put you through enough." So I kick open the door. It looks like a barracks building for the Air Force Academy. And there's these big tapestries on the wall, pictures of Saddam Hussein and cool stuff. And so I'm like, I'm ripping them off the wall. Like, I'll get a few of these and we can share them. And I get to the second floor, and it's like a barracks room. And there's, like, you know, Iraqi helmets and, you know, little just trinket stuff. And so as it happens, the door kicks open and I got my flight helmet on and behind me, and I whip around and it's the crew chief. He looks at me. He's like, "Sir, what the hell are you doing?" And I'm just like, you know, you know, you're not doing the right thing when you have a young sergeant telling you, "Let's go. You're better than this. Let's get cracking." He looks around. And he's like, "Holy crap!" So he starts grabbing. So we got a couple hats and a couple trinkets to make sure we have something for everybody. And I have run back to helicopter, and the Huey had landed. Another crew chief gets out, and we left. We took off, and then that was not my best day. Not my best day. And my CO kind of let me off the hook on that one. He just, a couple days later, was like, "Hey, if anyone's hunting for souvenirs, let's not do that." And I was like, "Whew, that was, I dodged a butt chewing right there." So I went happy. But yeah, it's happened. You know, you had a little extra time and figured, we didn't know if we'd ever be back there, and, you know, grab a couple flags or whatever just to take home. And
You know, you shared about, like, the absolute intensity of the experience, and, like, you know, your helicopter spinning around and doing 360s and, like, flying through a sandstorm and you can't see anything, and the just extreme danger and stress of it, that I feel like, you know, something that's a little on the prankish side to lighten the mood is, that's got to be, you got to let that slide.
Yeah, no, it was good. And I think we went right back into it after that. We were back up into Crit and the last of forces. So we got, you know, there's a lot of heavy use of us in the days ahead. But yeah, that was a prank. That's the best way to describe it. You know, it's that seventh grade you know, seventh grade boy in you comes out and you're just like, you can't help it. You go do it. So, yeah.
Exactly. Well, thank you for sharing that. I think it's a nice lighthearted thing that, you know, have a little fun while you're in the danger zone.
Right.
So, you know, thank you for sharing all this. As this is Can You Survive This Podcast, I have to ask you, are you up for a hypothetical survival scenario?
Absolutely.
Amazing. So, like I share with most of the guests, you know, the audience will follow along at home, hopefully have some entertainment, but also education. So if I give you an A, B choice, but you feel like you have a C, you know, I'd actually go with something else. Feel free to elaborate and we'll see how we do.
Absolutely.
All right. So let me get my notes out and all right, here we go. For this scenario, you are a lone soldier who's been separated from your unit during a mission in a hostile city. Your radio is malfunctioning and you have no way to connect to contact anyone for help. You must navigate the city and survive until you can find your way back to safety. First question, do you A, try to find a high vantage point to get your bearings, or B, stay put and wait for your unit to find you?
Yeah, it's a good one. You know, we would have, so that's, yeah, you know, C, it all depends, right? So, yeah, so normally if I'm trapped, right, I'm in a unit, I'm with your scenario, they know where I was. Someone knows where I was last seen to account for. We hopefully were a good unit and we had a accountability program or a rally point. If, hey, things go south when we get here, go back to here. Now, if that all fell through and they're gone and they just forgot about me, I am not waiting for anybody. I'll have my own personal E&E plan, escape and evasion plan. And it probably would be getting to a place where I feel I could orient my, if for some reason I wasn't oriented, if I had a map and I hadn't committed to memory, or I have a map and I wasn't sure where I was, I didn't have a GPS, you know, I would try to find a safe space where I could build the most situational awareness possible. And from there, it's decision-making time, right? These are decisions I'm making now because I'm in deep kimchi. So yeah, I think a combination of what I would do. I'm not waiting for anybody though. Unless okay. I was told to wait and I knew that was a great plan and I was that type of unit. So it's, you know, it's, you don't know, but in general, I'm going to put myself on my own back and get myself out of there.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You're not waiting around. Sounds like this is more of like an A, leaning towards A with a little bit of your own elaboration. So, you decide to find a high vantage point to get your bearings. You work your way up a tall building and see that you're several blocks away from your unit's last known location. As you start to make your way towards them, you hear gunfire in the distance. Do you A, head towards the gunfire to investigate the situation, or B, stealthily make your way towards your team's location, avoiding any potential conflict?
Yeah, that's good. Another good question. So gunfire is going to be, so if we're the only unit, it would sound like it was a, you know, kind of a one unit type event. So if anyone's shooting anyone, that's our guys shooting at their guys or their guys shooting at our guys. So if I could see, I would absolutely take a look to see where it is. You'd look at obvious avenues of approach. If I see another enemy, where would the enemy coming from? We probably know that already. Where there are other bases and stations to reinforce from. I don't want to walk up onto a unit unarmed. If I'm armed, that's fine. A person of one. I would go to the gunfire. That makes sense because that's most likely as stealthily as I can. So it's probably a combination of each. I'm not in a dead sprint because I look like an American. I have American kit on, depends where I am. And so I would stick out American weapons, et cetera. So I'd do that as quickly as I could, but I think my best choice, number one, I want to go help my unit out, and they're the ones probably taking the fire. And number two, if it's not my unit, it'll be another unit that is allied to me in some way. That makes sense. And number three, I want to be there to help. You know, I'm there to help. And that's my day job. So don't want to miss the fight.
Great. Great answer. I like that. Okay. So you make your way towards the unit. And as you make your way through the streets, you come across a group of hostile fighters. Do you engage the hostiles in combat or circumnavigate the hostiles by finding an alternate route?
You know, as a Marine, the essence of what we do on the ground is maneuver warfare, right? So you're looking for surfaces and gaps. So when I find a surface, that would be that enemy unit, I'm going to attempt to bypass them. Doesn't make it. So if my mission now is to link up with my unit, I'm going to bypass them because that's my number one goal. If my mission is to E&E, get myself out of there, I'm going to bypass a strong point, look for weak points, and try to find my unit. I think that makes sense without knowing more. So it's a little bit of a combination answer. You know, I don't need to sacrifice myself being hit by a squad of enemy that I could simply bypass if they're not doing anything right now. Report that enemy, you know, make it a better, you know, in theory, my mind thinks, hey, I can report where they are. I get around, link it with my unit. We can call in supporting arms, do other things. Vice me getting the random chance of, you know, maybe getting a couple bad guys and they're eventually going to get me with firepower. So, and I don't want to be dragged through the streets as a lone guy and be a propaganda tool either. So,
yeah.
All right. So, long answer. I should just give you A and B next time. How about that?
No, it's better this way because it's kind of, you know, it's educating the audience as we go. So thank you for that. Thank you for the extra explanation.
Sure.
And so it's basically B. Basically B. So you got that. You choose to circumnavigate the hostiles and find an alternate route. As you progress, you stumble upon a collapsed section of road obstructing your path. Do you A, cautiously navigate through the rubble, or B, go back the way you came?
Yeah, another good question. So, you know, I don't know anything about the rubble, the pieces. I don't know the history of it, how long we've been in this town or city, bypass places where they normally booby trapped. I'm looking at landmines or an IED of some sort. I don't necessarily want to go back the way I came because there's nothing back. We've determined there's nothing back there. There's no friendly forces, only enemy forces. So I think I'm, you know, I've had good luck so far. I'm trusting myself. If I don't know what it looks like, but if I think I can get around it or navigate it, I'll probably get around it and navigate it.
Very, very smart answer. Very smart. And you're foreshadowing what's to come because you decide to navigate through the rubble, carefully making your way through the debris, and you suddenly trigger a hidden explosive device. So do you A, quickly assess your injuries and administer first aid, or B, ignore the pain, press on, and allow adrenaline to drive you forward?
I don't think A is even probably an option. I think adrenaline's pumping anyway. I don't think it's in any of our DNA. It's not like it's a fight or flight piece. Unless I'm broken and I can't move, my brain says, number one, I'm going to get out of the way and get to cover as quickly as I can. And the enemy may be thinking it was a dog or a cat or a goat or whatever it was that triggered it. And they come there, they don't see anybody. Yeah, it could have been a goat. Who knows? Or whatever it's going to be. Or it got away. Or maybe they don't expect to see anything. I think adrenaline's going to carry the day anyway for a while. But yeah, me sitting there in the open, putting on an ACE bandage isn't going to do me any good. Now, if it's traumatic and I can't move, then I, you know, try to get out of the way best I can. But it's a tough one.
Great. So you press on and then you realize there are enemies closing in on your six. Do you A, crawl into a nearby sewer system, or B, hide in the rubble?
Crawl into a sewer system, rubble. So sewer system, I don't want to go any place where I know I can't get out. I don't want to be one grenade toss away from toast. So I don't want, there's no options, right? There's option A, you go in a tunnel, you don't know if it leads anywhere else. If sewer system may, but it may not. If you're talking rubbleized, if there's rubble in the area, that sewer system could be collapsed, et cetera. I also don't want to drown in the sewer system that I don't know has another duct going somewhere. So I'd probably get rid of that. That option's probably out. Hide in the rubble. You know, my intent would be to probably circumnavigate behind the unit again. Potentially if they're the ones going to the fight, to the sounds of the guns too, it's easier for me to follow them because they know where they're going if they're going to go reinforce their own troops. And it probably gives me a little more situational awareness of where our guys are, if I could do that, right? If I'm not so badly injured. But plain old hiding, yeah, I don't like like that. I don't like being hunted. It's no good for me.
Yeah. So you're going to navigate. You're kind of choosing. You're not going to the sewers, but you're not going to stay in the rubble either. You're going to navigate out of there and try to maybe get behind them or find some kind of tactical route that you can take.
Absolutely right. I'd probably get behind. If it looks to me like they're going to the fight, I'm going to try to get behind them or wait for them to pass and just shadow them the best I can. I'm not a ninja, you know, but I'd shadow them the best I possibly could. And if it seems like they're the ones that are going to the fight. So that's my best chance of finding my unit.
Yeah, smart. So you continue on and you head towards the next rendezvous point. When you get there, you find your unit has already moved on to a different location. Do you A, head straight to the next rendezvous point, or B, rest and assess the situation?
You know, I think it's C, all of the above, right? I think, you know, if it's a safe place and it was only known to us, so rendezvous points are usually, you know, it's safe. It wasn't compromised. I'm going to take a knee for a minute. If I was injured, I'm going to check myself out. I'm going to think about where the next place is. If I know I can find rendezvous point A, I'm going to rendezvous point B as an alternate. I likely have a map with me. I'd probably take some time to map out what I think is, are there fields? Is it a commercial area? Is it a downtown business area? Is it very urban? Is it a little bit of urban sprawl that can let me through there? Is it more rural that I can get through there? So that I would take a little bit of time to map my next trip. Not counting on my last successes, but it seems like I've made it this far. So I don't want to blow it now.
Excellent. Okay. Last question.
All right.
You continue on to the next rendezvous point, and as you do, you come across a wounded civilian who needs medical attention. Do you A, ignore the civilian and continue towards the rendezvous point, or B, provide medical aid to the civilian?
Well, this is the great moral dilemma we all face, isn't it? Right. This is my sophomore year philosophy class. It really all depends, right? You know, if it's a wounded civilian, you know, if it's a kid or somebody's sister, we're all humans, how bad are they hurt? If they're wounded there and they're bleeding at their leg and they don't see me, they're not going to, if it's life threatening, like they're dying and they're bleeding out, I'm not a surgeon. I can't fix that anyway. And their last words don't need to be screaming my name. Do I feel empathy? Absolutely. Am I sympathetic to any human? Of course I am. I'd have to assess how badly injured they were. And if I could really do any help, like what could I do triage wise? Like I give them a Band-Aid and a drink of water, but that cost me my life and it didn't necessarily save theirs, or they didn't need that type of saving. They were to live anyway. And that's an unnecessary sacrifice. So difficult question. I get where you're trying to, get there, but I don't have the answer for that one. Somewhere in between.
Yeah, that's actually a great answer, because on the last question, it's actually A or B could be correct, know, and so well said. You know, you have to kind of deduce it. Am I going to be able to actually help, or is this going to actually cost you your life, and you never even were able to help him anyways? You have to assess that. So well said. And so you continue on and you finally reach the rendezvous point. You meet up with your unit and together you're able to call for extraction and make it to safety back to base. Congratulations. You have survived this podcast.
Very cool. Thank you.
Thanks for playing along. And thanks so much for coming on. Really very amazing insights. I would love to have you back sometime, maybe when your next book comes out.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely.
But in the meantime, where can people find you? Where can people find your book? The book is Ghosts of Baghdad. But where can people find you if they want more info or anything like that?
Yeah, great. So it's tough. It's ericbuehr.com is my website. And on there, you can order books. You can order them through my publisher, Ballas, and happy to sign them for you. And you can order them through, there's links to Amazon and Barnes & Noble. But you can get the book anywhere you want to get your books. It's available in hardcover through, Target and Ballast and Amazon and It's also on Kindle. It's on an Audible. Kent Lutt does a great Audible version of it. You can get it on Audible. And so it's really open to anywhere you want to find your best books. But if you want to know more about what I'm doing, I'll have this podcast on when it finally, whenever it comes out, I'll put it on. You can hit my, my website, look in the media pages, see interviews, see articles I write, stay in touch however you like.
Fantastic. EricBure.com.
That's it.
And the book is Ghosts of Baghdad. And yeah, thanks again for coming on, and bye everyone.
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.